Okay, can everyone hear? Can you hear in the back? We don't need to turn that up? Great, okay. You know, the word meditation really doesn't appear in Buddhist literature. There really is no equivalent word for the word meditation. Meditation is kind of this generic English word that covers a lot. It appears in a lot of different traditions. So it has a very, very broad meaning. But the word that does appear in the Buddhist texts has a little bit different meaning. And that word is bhavana. And bhavana is translated as cultivation. So if we reflect for just a minute on what it is to cultivate something, it has a little bit different meaning than actually doing something like meditation. It has more of a meaning of participating in a process, being part of a process, and participating in it, and also being one of the catalysts in a process. So we might reflect for just a minute on what it might mean, for instance, to cultivate a plant. We really tend it, you know. We don't just dump it in the ground and throw some water on it. We really do a lot of things. We prepare the soil. We make sure it's the right kind of soil for the plant. We cultivate it. We add nutrients. We protect it from the wind. We give it just the right amount of water and just the right amount of light so it can grow. And so that's really what we're doing here too. What we're doing is sati bhavana, which means the cultivation of mindfulness. So we're doing something that really involves a whole processual thing. We're sitting with a group of people who support our practice. We're sitting in an atmosphere that's conducive to practice. And then we're bringing our own attention to bear on our meditation subject, on our mindfulness. And mindfulness is one of those words that has come into the English jargon. We hear the word mindfulness very often these days. Even in a restaurant, you walk into a restaurant and they may say something like, oh, be mindful of the step on the way to your table. Or somebody might say to you, be mindful of the traffic driving home. And we even hear about athletes and football players who are trained in mindfulness. Peter and I had somebody who came and spoke to us when we were doing our training. George Mumford, who trains athletes in mindfulness. But the mindfulness that we're talking about here is of a little bit different nature than that type of mindfulness. We're talking about wise mindfulness. And wise mindfulness as a mental training. And it's a mental training that leads to wisdom and leads to freedom. It has no other purpose than just a form of attention that is meant only to attend. A form of intention that is just for its own sake. And its goal is to lead us to wisdom. And it's not that playing tennis or playing poker doesn't involve a similar kind of focus and awareness. It's just that the ultimate purpose is not the same. Nothing wrong with that, but this has a little bit different result. And in the context of the Buddhist teachings, mindfulness is an inherently wholesome activity, if we can call it an activity. And it can lead only to wholesome results. And that doesn't mean that the object of our mindfulness may not sometimes be unpleasant or even painful. But it still, even under those circumstances, is a totally wholesome process. And one of the reasons that we take the precepts at the beginning of a retreat is to remind us that we are engaged in a morally wholesome process. In his discourses, the Buddha enumerated four ways of being present or attending to mindfulness. Four ways that we could focus our attention in order to help us be mindfulness. As we said this morning and last night, mindfulness is simply being aware of what's happening as it's happening. Or another way of putting it that I kind of like is to be with whatever is happening, with presence and open-heartedness. And the presence and open-heartedness are really important because they have an air of receptivity. We need to receive the mindfulness with an open-hearted attitude, an attitude of non-judgment, an attitude of welcoming whatever is arising. But tonight I would like to focus primarily on mindfulness of the body. And this was the first way of being present that the Buddha suggested that we attend to, using the body as our primary object for mindfulness. And we've talked today about mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing is one of the really fundamental core ways of being present in the body. We also spoke about mindfulness of postures. That is another way under mindfulness of the body that the Buddha suggested that we pay particular attention to. And one of the reasons that we're paying particular attention to postures is that even 2,500 years ago, the Buddha noticed that it's very easy to lose consciousness when we're changing postures, to lose our mindfulness and to lose our attention. I don't know why that is, but it seems to be fairly true. I know that once on an intensive retreat, I decided to take a week and do nothing but note postures. And it became extremely demanding just to be present when I changed postures and then to be aware of the posture that I was in. So simply, postures, standing, sitting, walking, lying down. One of the teachers from India who taught a lot of our teachers, Munindraji, used to say to his students, he used to say, just be aware that you're sitting, and the entire practice will open from there. Just if you can be aware that you're sitting, the whole practice will open up from that awareness. So since we're in this wonderful, beautiful, natural setting, I want to focus on the five physical senses. And as many of you know, in Buddhism, there are actually six senses: hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and the sixth one is mind. So there are six senses. So why are we emphasizing this so much? Why is there so much emphasis on being aware of the body? One reason is that the body is always in present time. If you want to be present, all you have to do is just tune into your body. Your body is never in the past. It's never in the future. It's always in the present moment. So at any time, walking down the street, waking up in the morning, eating, all we have to do is just tune into our breath, tune into our posture, tune into the five physical senses, and we will be tuning into the present moment. Another reason, and this is a very, very important reason, that the Buddha suggested that we use the body and the physical senses as the object of our mindfulness, is that to know the body, to really be present with any of the senses, like we were doing with hearing, for instance, out in the meadow, or like we were doing with seeing, to really be present is to know the body not as a solid object, but to know the body as an organic, dynamic, constantly changing process. And maybe you noticed that already when we were out there doing the hearing, or maybe when we were doing the walking. And another reason for using the body as the object of mindfulness is that to know the body, to know the five physical senses plus the sixth sense of mind, is to know the entire universe. Can any of you think of any other way to know something other than through one of the six senses? Hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, or mind. That's the only way we have of knowing anything in the world, is through one of those six senses. So becoming familiar with them and being able to tune in on them is very important. So there's nothing in the universe that can't be known through one of the six senses. And the five physical senses of hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling make up five. Five-six of the senses are the physical senses. So we're going to be doing this throughout the retreat. We're really going to be focusing on these five physical senses. In normal everyday life, you usually don't do what we're doing here, where you notice just one sense at a time. It seems like we're experiencing several senses at once. It looks like, you know, in daily life, like we're seeing and hearing and smelling all at once. But when you start to slow things down, we start to experience them much differently. We start to be able to focus on one sense at a time. A few years ago, I read a really interesting review of a book. And what it was a collection of memoirs that had been written by people who were in the process of going blind. And what they did is they described their experience. They described what it was like to go blind. And in describing that, they described how other senses started to compensate for their blindness. They became very heightened and very acute. And so when we start thinking about focusing on one sense, think about that. Think about this sense door, hearing, or maybe we'll do some seeing tomorrow, or smelling. This sense door is the way that I can know the universe in this given moment. And just let the others float into the background and focus on one sense. So what I would like to do tonight is I would like to go through each of the five physical senses and just talk a little bit about them and how we might work with them during the retreat. So let's start with seeing. I think that of all our senses, probably the most dominant sense for most people, unless they're blind, the most dominant sense is seeing. Look at the way we speak about things. We use sight as a metaphor for almost everything. We use sight as a metaphor for hearing. we use sight as a metaphor for mental understanding. We use sight as a metaphor for expressing an opinion. We say things like, in my view, this or that. Or we say, I see what you mean, for I understand, or I see what you're saying. We talk about reading people's body language. We talk about seeing someone's point of view. And we even refer to this practice as what? Insight meditation. Another beautiful use of the metaphor of sight, insight. As we go through the five physical senses, notice how you experience them. Some of them are very external. For instance, sight is very external. We usually don't experience it internally that often. And there are some that are very internal, that are only internal, like taste. We experience it totally internally. And then there are some, like we did today with hearing, where we experience them both internally and externally. So with seeing, sometimes when we have our eyes closed, we do experience colors or images internally. But most of our seeing happens externally. We see something out in the external world. It's really kind of interesting, evolutionarily, as sight developed really as a way of being in two places at once. Very interesting. A creature, and now us humans, can be over there, and we can be here at the same time. It's a very miraculous and protective thing when you think about it. Sight is just an amazing sense that we have. But it's also probably the most proprietary. Things out there appear so solid that we really tend to own them as soon as we see them. It's very difficult to look at something and not immediately have something come up in your mind. That's a light, that's a chair, that's a table, that's a person. So we jump very, very quickly from simply seeing shapes and colors to perception to labeling. But do we really see? Are things sometimes taken in so fast and labels given to things so quickly that we don't really see what's going on? There's this Native American story about the arrival of Columbus in the New World. And as the story goes, when Columbus's ships started to approach what's now the Haiti and the Dominican Republic, the native people that were living there didn't see the ships. They were completely invisible to them. And that was because they were not within their realm of perception. They had never seen anything like these enormous things coming over the ocean with these big white billowy sails. And so they just didn't see them. And what happened was, so the story goes, is that it took the shamans and it took the medicine men and the medicine women to actually see them, because the ordinary people could not see the ships. And these people, these shamans and medicine men and medicine women, had trained their vision, kind of like we're doing here, to really see, to really experience without delusion, to be able to see what is in front of us. So it's helpful when you open your eyes after you've been sitting to just let your eyes be soft, to not immediately reach out and grab things with your eyes and start naming them, to just try to look out like we were doing today when we were walking and then looking, seeing shapes, colors, seeing distance, seeing proximity, before automatically just naming something. This is a tree, this is a blade of grass, this is a person. Seeing things in relationship to each other. Seeing not just the object, but seeing what's sometimes called non-objective space. Because things are made up not just of objects, they're also formed by the space that's around them. So when we look, we see an object, and then we see non-objective space around it. So when we're out in nature, just gently look at things, as if seeing for the first time, as if you've never seen a tree before. Really take it in. And we'll be doing more of that, you know, looking at objects and looking at them more closely to start to really see. We don't usually think of seeing as being selective, do we? We think more in terms of seeing is believing, right? I saw it. It's got to be true. But to the contrary, there have been dozens of experiments done that say quite differently, that seeing isn't necessarily believing. There's this short film presentation, and I think you can, I don't know the name of it, but I know it's on YouTube. And it's shown for all kinds of different reasons. I saw it in a diversity workshop. Another friend of mine saw it in a workshop on depression. But it's really a little short film clip about perception. And in the film, you're asked to sit and watch this little film clip. And there are some kids in a schoolyard. And they're under a basketball hoop. And they're playing basketball. And they're dribbling the ball around. And they're passing it back and forth. And they're throwing it into the hoop. And you're told to watch the ball. Just throughout about a 10-minute film clip, you're told to keep your eye on this basketball that's going back and forth, which everybody does. And then when the film's over, you're asked to say what you saw. And people say, well, I saw them do this, and I saw them dribble the ball over there, and I saw them pass it, and I saw them put it through the hoop. And then you're shown the film again. And to your surprise, what happens is, in the film, there is actually someone in a gorilla suit that has walked right through the schoolyard, in and out of the game, and across the screen. And nobody saw it. And the reason they didn't see it is because they were focusing on one thing to the exclusion of other things. So this can happen when we're seeing. We don't see everything. Like those native peoples, they were focused to the exclusion on one thing and not on those ships that were arriving. So as we learn to be mindful, and as we learn to really be with our experience, we start to take in things that we didn't see before. Life can be very interesting when we start to really start to see the whole picture, start to see with less delusion in our lives and with more mindfulness. The next sense door that I want to talk about is hearing, which we did today. Helen Keller said, we should do more for deaf people because she felt that as a blind person, that the loss of connection for people who couldn't hear, their loss of connection to the world was much greater than that of a blind person. Can you imagine a world without sound? What would that be like? I mean, what would it be like if you walked outside and you didn't hear the river and you didn't hear the birds? So where did you experience sound today when we were doing that exercise out there, when we were listening to the wind and to the river? Where did you experience sound? Did you experience it in the distance? Did you experience it inside your head? Did you experience it maybe right at the opening of your ear? Where do you experience things? This is very interesting, and you know, there's no right answer to this. We all have our own way of experiencing. I can only relate my own experience, and you have to really discover what your own experience is. Sometimes sound isn't felt in any of those ways. Sometimes it's just felt as a vibration in the body. It's a really interesting sensation to experiment with, because it's often not really clear where the sound is, whether it's inside or outside. And I think this is one of the reasons that sound is often given as a meditation subject. Especially if you notice where you're breathing and you're just focused on one little area of your body and your meditation is starting to get kind of tight, open to sound and see what happens. Because it's not apparent if it's inside or outside. It can create a really wonderful feeling of spaciousness. It can really open up the space of the mind and make us feel a lot more open and take us out of a tight, narrow feeling. The mind can feel lighter, more spacious when we're focusing on sound. A few years ago, I was doing a six-week retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And my teacher suggested that I just have two objects of meditation for the entire 6 weeks. And that was the breath and sound. Just those two things. It was really interesting. And I think what was so interesting about it is, especially with sound, that you almost have to sit back and receive it. It's very hard to reach out to experience sound. So what it did is it created in my practice this sense of receptivity, of just allowing things to happen and then opening towards them with mindfulness, to just allow the sound to be there. The other thing that's really interesting to experiment with sound is that sounds come and go. Sometimes they come and go very quickly. Sometimes they come and go very slowly. But they do come and go. And so it's very interesting to note when you first hear a sound, when you first notice it, when you first hear a bird outside, a bird call, and then notice the transition as you listen to that sound until you can't hear it anymore. It's a wonderful way to start experiencing one of the great truths of life, which is impermanence, that everything arises and passes away. So just noting sound arising and passing away. And really, we're in a perfect setting. I can't think of a better setting to experiment with sound. We've got the wind, sometimes too much of it for some of us, but we have the wind. Sometimes it's a gentle wind. Sometimes it's a hard wind. We have the sound of the water. We have the sound of the birds. We have the sound of the leaves in the trees. So we have lots of really, really wonderful sounds to open to. and to see where we experience them, and to feel that sense of spaciousness around the sound. The next of the sense doors that I want to talk about is tasting. And we did some of that today with Peter's wonderful meditation on eating the raisin, which was really great. So after breathing, what's more basic to our survival than eating? It's really primary. It's important. And we put a lot of energy into it. You know, if we didn't eat, we'd die. It's a very important survival mechanism that we have food and that we figure out what's edible and where we can get it and how much we can eat of it and so forth. And it's also a very unique sense because it's one of those senses that is perceived as totally inside of us. We don't experience tasting as outside. It's totally inside. And I think that this makes the taste very, very personal. We all have a very personal relationship to what we're tasting. And it's probably the source of a lot of sayings like, it's not to my taste, which means something very personal. It's not to my taste. Or he or she has good taste. Or it's a matter of personal taste. So it's a very interior experience that we have around the sense of taste. And our relationship to food, boy, is it interesting. Maybe just being here a day, you've already discovered that in the dining hall. Our relationship to food is really complex. And it's become, over the last several thousand years, it's become extremely complex. For the first humans, all they had to do was go out there and find out, first of all, what was edible, which is how taste developed. People had to know what was edible, so they would experience something as sweet, sour, bitter, salty. These were all survival things, you know. Was it worth eating? Was it a source of energy? Was it a source of minerals? So it was very simple. And even today, believe it or not, that's all we taste, is those four things. And everything else is a mental construct. Flavor is a mental construct. Flavor involves taste. It involves memory. It involves what something looks like. It involves smell. All of these things. So our taste and our sense of flavor, our ideas around food, have really changed. They've gone from survival mode to all kinds of culturally shaped ideas about food. And we have very different culturally shaped ideas about food than, say, people in Asia do. We have very definite ideas about the presentation of food, what food should look like. Raisins are raisin color. Raisins are not red, right? If the raisin today was red, it might have altered the way it tasted even. That can happen. So food presentation, what happens is, because there is all of this around food presentation and what food looks like, we can have a lot of really strong likes and dislikes around food. If it doesn't taste the way we expected, if it doesn't look the way we expected, we can have very strong feelings about it. Memory plays a very, very important role in what our perception of food is. I know Whenever I go to one of those fast food places and you get an egg sandwich and the egg is square, you know? Have you ever gotten one of those? They make them so they're kind of the shape of the bread. It's weird. It almost makes it taste weird because this is not my memory of an egg. An egg is round. And so we have definite ideas about food. And all of this is going on in the dining room when we're in there. No wonder we're eating our thoughts and not our food. Because it's a really complex thing that is happening in the dining room. It is often very difficult to be present. So we suggest things like putting down your fork and closing your eyes, just focusing on taste for a while. Looking at the food like we did with the raisin. When you put your plate down, look at the food. See what role seeing plays in our relationship to what we're eating. So this is all part of eating meditation. So there's lots of things to do and to think about when we're in the dining room. Just keep it simple. Chew the food slowly. Swallow slowly. Allow it to be part of your meditation. A lot more complex than sitting on the cushion doing eating meditation, I think. Very challenging. So being awake in the dining hall is just as important as being awake in the meditation hall. Being mindful, being aware of what we're doing. The next of the sense doors, sometimes we call them sense doors or sense gates or physical senses, is smelling. And smelling is very closely related to tasting. I think you know, everybody knows when you have a cold, what happens to your sense of taste. It's really hard to taste. So smell is really part of the way we experience taste and the way we experience flavor. And the source of smells are molecules floating in the air or floating up our nasal passages when we're eating to allow us to enhance our experience of what we're eating. And as humans, I would say that smell is definitely not as important as it once was in our evolutionary process. Smell was probably one of the earliest senses that creatures had, of any kind of creature had, was a sense of smell. It was very important, probably even before things like hearing and tasting. We have maybe 17% of the capacity that a dog has to smell something. We've lost a lot of our sense of smell. But it's still a very important sense door to focus on. And here in this wonderful setting in the wilderness, I know this always happens to me. Whenever I'm in at Vallecitos or out in the wilderness, my senses, especially the sense of smell, becomes very heightened. I start to be aware of things that I'm not usually aware of in everyday life. There's all the wonderful smells of musts and trees and flowers are really there very powerfully. So as we have evolved, we've kind of lost a lot of our sense of smell, but it's still important for infants. A lot of the bonding that infants do is through their sense of smell, the bonding with their parents. And as adults, like with taste, we tend to have very strong likes and dislikes. We don't feel very neutral about odors or musts or smells. And one of the reasons for that is the sense of smell bypasses the cognitive part of our brain. And so it just goes into the part that likes or doesn't like something. Um, smell is very interesting. Smell or odor or aroma. We have, look at all the words we have for smells. Something has a smell, a must, an odor, an aroma. Maybe you can think of a few others. There's lots of them. One of the things that's so interesting is that to smell something is really to have an immediate sense of impermanence. We can't smell something. Something does not have a smell. It's not giving off any molecules in the air unless it's either decaying or evaporating. So this is an immediate sense of the impermanence of the world that we're living in. When we smell a flower, it's giving off a fragrance only because that flower is dying. When we smell the wonderful aroma of coffee in the morning, that aroma is only available because the oil is being pressed out of the beans. It's evaporating. And I've started using this a lot more in my life because I'm finding it really interesting. I love to experiment with these things. Just in my daily life, I will use, just walking out to my car, I'll just stop and just kind of sniff and smell what I can in the air and use it as a way to ground myself in the present moment, to ground myself with whatever odor is in the air. Another way that the sense of smell is impermanent is actually in our noses. Our noses become very saturated quickly with the smell. If you go and kind of stick your nose in one of the beautiful ponderosa trees and there's that nice vanilla smell that you get when you smell in there. If you just kind of keep your nose in there, the smell will start, even though it's still there, it will start to dissipate. We can only smell things for so long. Some kind of an adaptive thing. I'm not sure what it is. But it's also a way of noticing impermanence in smells. Smells, like some of the other senses, tend to evoke memories. I was taking a hike with a friend last weekend. We were up in Santa Barbara Canyon, which is a very beautiful area, very leafy with a river running through. And the entire hike, she kept saying, oh, this reminds me of that. Oh, this reminds me of the time I did that. Oh, this reminds me when I was here. This really reminds me of something else. So smell is like that. Notice it when you walk outside and you smell something. See if it evokes a memory. And I'm not saying this in the sense that we have to be looking for memories or looking for stories around things, but this is just all part of our experience of a sense. All we have to do is just note that there's a memory arising and then let it go. So this can be part of our investigation, noticing how fleeting odors are and aromas, noticing what's called up in the mind when we smell something. When does eating meditation start? The first minute we get a nice whiff of the smell of lunch coming from the other room, that is the beginning of our eating meditation. That's the beginning of mindfulness around eating and smell and taste. The last of the senses that I want to talk about is the sense of touch. Sense of touch is really interesting, and we've been working with this a little bit, you know, as we've, say, notice what it feels like to sit, notice what it feels like to lie down, notice what the texture is underneath you. So the sense of touch actually composes a number of different experiences. And the first one, and one that we've been talking about, is the pressure of contact. Feeling our sit bones on the cushion. Feeling the weight of the body. Feeling the pressure of the body touching the ground. feeling the weight of the body in your feet when you're standing, feeling that pressure of contact. Another way to experience touch is through temperature. When you touch something, is it hot? Is it cold? Is it lukewarm? Another aspect of touch is pleasurable touch or pain, unpleasurable touch. And yet another one, and one we don't think about too often, is sensing the body spatially. Peter was talking about that a little bit in walking back, in that four-part walking. Sensing the body spatially, knowing where your body is in space. We hardly ever think about this. We just take it for granted. Where is my body in space? In that memoir that I mentioned on blindness, one of the people who described his experience as he was going blind was someone who, as a compensation for his blindness, really started to develop the spatial sense of the body. Where are your arms and legs in space? He would do things like, he would go out in the middle of the night and he would decide to re-roof his house. And he'd be up there on the top of his roof, and he would be scurrying back and forth over the top of that roof. He would be hanging precariously over the side, over the edge of the roof, up there with his tools, re-roofing his house. And his neighbors would stand outside just kind of looking at him. You know, this guy's crazy. He's going to fall off there. But he wasn't going to fall off because he had developed this sense so acutely that he knew exactly where his body was in space. And we know this too. We know this when you're standing there and your eyes are closed, you know where your arms and legs are. You know if your arm is in front of you. You know if you're holding your arm up in the air. You know if it's down behind you, below you. We know where we are in space. And this sense, actually, there are people who are sometimes born without this. It's a very precarious world they live in without this spatial sense that we take for granted. So it's another thing that we can explore when we're just standing. Close your eyes. Feel the whole body. Feel the body in space. When you're walking, feeling the body move through space, knowing where your limbs are. So we experience this sense of touch through the skin. And the skin is the largest organ in the body. It really is an organ. And if we were to take any of you with a huge rolling pin and kind of roll you out flat, your skin would cover about 20 square feet. That's huge. When you compare the organ of skin to, for instance, the eye, or you compare it to the nose, or you compare it to your ear, it's really a large organ. So it's our most immediate contact with the world. You know, we touch something. And when we touch something, we know that thing. We know its size. We know its hardness. We know its temperature. We know whether it's soft. We know its weight if we're holding it. We know the difference between, even with our eyes closed, touching a piece of metal and touching a piece of wood. We know it by the temperature. If we're lifting it, we know it by the weight. So the skin has this amazing ability to really read the world. It's how objects are known. And there are different parts of the body that really tend to have a greater concentration of nerve endings. For instance, if the wind is blowing across your face, or the feeling of your clothes touching your body, that's a really light touch, right? You don't really read that accurately. But the hands, the feet, the lips are really the most, what we might say, intelligent parts of this organ that we call the skin. We talk about feeling or touching something. When we talk about that, we're usually referring to our hands. What does it feel like? What does the surface feel like? These are all areas where we can learn to be mindful. Mindful of the body. Mindful of what things feel like. When you were laying down out there, I'm sure you felt the difference between sitting on a soft cushion and laying on the ground with the grass and the pine needles. The skin is extremely sensitive. So what happens when you bring awareness to this wonderful organ that we know of as the skin? What happens when we bring awareness to an itch or a pain or a tingling feeling? Is it impermanent? Does it stay the same? Does it move around? Does it go away? These are all things that we can explore with the sense of touch. We often tend to think of our bodies as the surface, as our image, as how we look. We don't usually think of our bodies as our spleen or our liver. We usually think of our bodies as our image, what we see in the mirror. But there's much more going on. When you think about it, of the five physical senses, four of them happen exclusively from the neck up. Seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling. We experience those from the neck up. Our sense of touch, 90% of it is experienced from the neck down. That's huge. That's most of our body experiences this sense store of touch. So when we think of the brain, we think of that as the part of our body that knows. But the body, everything from the neck down, really has its own wisdom. It knows. It's intelligent. For instance, when someone comes up behind you and they tap you on the shoulder, your body knows. It knows exactly where it's been touched. It knows exactly how it's been touched, even without seeing this person. And sometimes it even knows who has touched it and why it has been touched. All this is the intelligence of this body that we have, our sense of touch. So there's a lot going on to the sense doors. You know, it's kind of a wonder that we could ever be bored in our life, especially that we could ever be bored while we're sitting on the cushion, that we could ever be bored during a retreat. Because when you look at all the possibilities of what there is to explore, it's vast. And we have this whole week to do that, to explore all of these things. So to be present in the body really is to know the whole universe and to know the intelligence of the body. I'd just like to close with a short verse from a Mary Oliver poem. I was going to read her poem, Mindfulness, tonight, but I think I'll read it tomorrow morning. And the reason I thought of this one is it just, it reminded me so much of us just being down on the river and laying there and listening to the sound. She says, "The dream of my life is to lie down by a slow river and stare at the light in the trees. To learn something by being nothing for a little while, but the rich lens of attention. The dream of my life is to lie down by a slow river and stare at the light in the trees. To learn something by being nothing for a little while, but the rich lens of attention." So let's just sit together for a few minutes. Let's just take about a walking period about 15 minutes, and then we'll come back in here for the final sitting this evening.